Good evening, it's 5 p.m. on Thursday, March 12th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we visit a portrait exhibit at the Tech Gallery, challenging the stigma around homelessness, sharing the stories of Kingston residents who have experienced housing insecurity and found support through Lionhearts. A Kingston-born photographer shares a national milestone with his work now traveling across the country, and some news out of City Hall this week, including updates from Council's last meeting, a joint statement from the mayors of Kingston and South Frontenac and Safe South Frontenac on the Alto Rail Project, and the start of another University District Safety Initiative period leading up to St. Patrick's Day next week. Without further delay, let's dive in. This week, an exhibit on display at the Tet Center is highlighting the stories of people in Kingston who have faced homelessness and who have found support through Lionhearts. The exhibit, entitled A Sheltered Life, features portraits of 10 individuals who have experienced housing insecurity, with their redemptive stories displayed alongside the work. The project includes work by artists Sherry Dosager, Ben Spadzinski, and Kyla Todd, and also serves as a fundraiser supporting Lionhearts' transitional housing initiatives. At present, 34 persons have been placed into safe, affordable homes through Lionhearts. Still, as of early 2026, more than 570 people in Kingston are experiencing homelessness. Through this exhibit, the artists hope to bring attention to the human stories behind those numbers. I joined artist Kyla Todd at the Tet Gallery this week, and she shared how the project first came together.
Well, it started, I would say, like over a year ago. I was chatting with my friend Al Dosager, and I said to him, I have this idea of drawing, painting portraits and telling stories. And he was like, that's a great idea. And I said, but, you know, I can't do it myself. Like, I don't have a connection with anyone, really. But he did. Like, he works at Lionhearts. And so we decided to work together. And he, because he's sort of like on the ground, you know, like chatting with people. He's somebody that people trust really well. And so he was like, okay, this is a good idea. I'm going to make it happen. It started off slowly. Like, I didn't hear anything for like a few months. And then one day, Al and I, we went and we chatted with some people at the line. It was actually at the shelter that was on Adelaide at the time. And that was, I think, maybe in the summer. And then in September, it was myself, Al, and Sherry, who's the other artist. We all got together and we started chatting. And so from there, it was like Al's job to figure out, okay, who first of all, people have to be willing to tell their stories, right? So whose stories are we going to tell? And then once we started to figure out whose stories we're going to tell, it was like Sherry and I wanted to meet them. So, and the only person that I painted that I didn't get to meet was Andrew, or Andy, but everyone else, like I went down and Ben, our photographer, took a lot of the really awesome, you know, photos, but the ones that I painted from, most of them, except for Andrew, like I took just because I was there meeting with them. We figured out, so I would have figured out who I was painting at least maybe about by December is when my first painting was Justin, so I started painting him, and then basically I spent like the month of January and February, like that's all I did was paint.
Todd says the project was always about more than creating portraits. The artists wanted the work to help people connect with the stories behind each face.
What I wanted, like, and why I wanted to be art is because, you know, like art is it connects you with people, right? You look at an art piece and you feel something in your heart for whatever reason. And even when you're painting, like creating a piece of art is like, it's like a part of you. Do you know what I mean? So the whole purpose of this was to show really that we're all connected. You know what I mean? Like we're all humans. These people are in a situation, but we're connected with them. And the idea was to hopefully make us realize that really this could happen to anyone. Like we're all like a tragedy or two or like a few really bad months away from being in this situation ourselves. And so creating art is like a way of breaking down a barrier, I felt.
Every portrait was created with that connection in mind, placing each person in a setting that reflected part of their personal story.
Well, definitely when we were doing the portraits, we wanted there to be context. Because for one thing, when it's just a painting of, say, a face, and you don't necessarily know the person, you may not feel as connected to just a face. But if you see somebody sitting on bleachers, for example, and you can imagine being there with them. So, like, doing the portraits in a context was important to show a bit about who they are and their situations. So Andy's on the bleachers because that's where he lived for a good chunk of time, like under the bleachers. So when they found him, when they were able to talk to him, that's where they talked to him, on the bleachers, because that's where he was living for a good chunk of time. And Kenny right here, this is the painting with a mop and the bucket. So we painted him in this long hallway because that's the hallway of the shelter. So if you read his story, you'll realize that he has been working at the shelter. But just showing him in this context was important to us, mm-hmm. You know, and Phyllis knitting. So for me, like, Phyllis is the one that her story breaks my heart. Well, they all are heartbreaking, but just to know that she's in a safe place right now and knitting, that it's really important.
Since the opening show last weekend, Todd says the exhibit has drawn strong reactions from visitors, many of whom have been deeply moved by the stories being shared.
There's quite a lot of people here, and people were moved by the stories, and we had some people who were crying, you know, because it's really sad, some of the situations. And people were very happy that that we've done this. And I was talking to a woman from City Hall, and she wants to take the whole thing down to City Hall. It's a possibility. And people were just overall very supportive of the project. And I think a lot of people resonated with sort of our intentions. Certain people resonated with certain people's stories, right? Like, so some people would come up to me and say, like, oh my gosh, like, Phyllis's story. And I was like, I know. You know, so people saying that they really loved the stories. They loved how they were written. They loved how, it was Al who wrote the stories, and it just felt like somebody was just speaking. Do you know what I mean? Like, it didn't feel formal. It just felt like a person telling the story in a really meaningful way.
For Todd, the goal of the project is ultimately connection, helping people recognize the humanity they share with those whose lives have taken very different paths.
I hope that they walk away feeling a greater sense of their connection to other humans. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're all in this together, and we are here, I don't know, we're here for each other. Like, this idea that we are separate from each other, like, I want us to be able to understand this, like, shared humanity that we have.
A Sheltered Life will be on display in the Tech Gallery until Friday, March 13th. Kingston-born photographer Brett Hitchens is seeing his work travel across the country, one letter at a time. Canada Post has selected Hitchens Photography for its 2026 annual Flower Series commemorative stamps, featuring cherry blossoms photographed at Vancouver's Natobe Memorial Garden. While Hitchens now lives and works on the West Coast, he grew up on a family farm just outside of Kingston, a connection to the landscape he says continues to shape how he sees and photographs the world. I spoke with Brett about his Kingston roots and what it means to have his work featured on a stamp collection that will circulate nationwide. To start us off, you grew up in the Kingston region. How did that landscape kind of shape your eye as a photographer?
Yeah, definitely. I grew up on a family farm just outside of Kingston, kind of in the West End. And my grandparents' family is from Amherst Island. And I feel like as a kid out in the country, you're just kind of like always out in the in the yard, on the farm, exploring kind of like in the forest and the trails and stuff. And I feel like, yeah, just as a person, a photographer, especially moving to a big city, it's like you kind of don't realize how special that is, but just be able to go kind of like explore and roam in the landscape. So yeah.
And when you heard your photos were going to be part of the 2026 flower series, what was your first initial reaction?
Yeah, really exciting. The project kind of started 2 years ago. And so it's been like a long process. And so we've known for a little bit that it's come out. And yeah, to kind of finally be released to the public is really special. I think it's an honor that not many photographers ever get the opportunity to have their work focused, kind of to ever get their work featured on a stamp. And so yeah, just it feels really special.
Yeah, and you kind of got into it there, but what does it mean for you to have your work featured on this national series, and to know that it's traveling across the country?
Honestly, like I said, I think it's really special. A lot of friends and family have been reaching out and sharing congratulations, and it's something that'll kind of live forever, which is really nice to kind of be able to look back on in several years from now, hopefully, and just kind of remember, it's kind of accomplishment. But yeah, it's just nice to kind of share it amongst everybody.
Awesome. And your stamp features cherry blossoms. I was wondering what drew you to photographing these blooms in particular.
Yeah, I photograph a lot for the Van Dusen Botanical Gardens. And so that's kind of how I got connected on the collaboration for the assignment. I worked with John Belisle, who is the graphic designer. And we got partnered with the Nairobi Botanical Garden at UBC, which is a Japanese botanical gardens, and they feature a lot of common and rare cherry trees. So yeah, the directive was from Canada Post to capture cherry blossoms, and so that was kind of part of the assignment. But just as a whole, like I love capturing kind of like home and gardens and public landscapes, botanical gardens, and cherry trees are just so kind of fleeting, beautiful, and their blossoms are just like really a unique, exciting thing to capture in photography.
And even though you're based in Vancouver now, do you still see connections between your work and your Kingston roots?
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, I think I kind of grew up in kind of playing around on like family farm and in the landscape. So as much as I've been out in Vancouver for several years now, I still have strong family connections back in Kingston. I love kind of coming back every year and just exploring the area again, and especially going to Amherst Island. I find that landscape over there is just like really inspiring. Like rural agricultural Ontario, but like really quiet, really peaceful. And I think that kind of stillness is something that I reflect back on and kind of bring to my work today.
That was Kingston-born photographer Brett Hitchens, whose images are featured in Canada Post's 2026 annual Flower Series stamps. The new stamps are now available through Canada Post. Before we get into more local news this evening, I'm going to turn to your weather and traffic report featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, March 12th, daytime high of 1 degree, overnight low of minus 7. Friday, March 13th, that's right, Friday the 13th, a scary little bit of snow in the forecast. Not too much accumulation, but you hate to see it all the same. Going to feel closer to minus 4, even though the daytime high is listed at 2. Saturday, March 14th, right around 0 for your daytime high, feeling closer to minus 6. Sunday, March 15th, high of 3 degrees, but afternoon snow in the forecast, feeling closer to minus 4. And then starting off next week, Monday, March 16th, daytime high of 3, feeling closer to minus 4, with an overnight low of minus 12. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. As a reminder, overnight street parking restrictions have been eased as of March 1st. This means that overnight street parking is only banned when the weather conditions require it. In terms of road closures for the week, Aberdeen Street from Johnson to William is closed indefinitely to accommodate construction activity and staging in the area. The other major road closure for this week is Berry Street to Queen, which is closed indefinitely for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. That's it. That's all I have for you this week. This is Jesse Bell signing off and wishing you all safe travels.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. It's a moment many Kingston residents have experienced more than once this winter. The snowplow finally clears your street and leaves a heavy ridge of snow across the end of your driveway. Councillor Ryan Bohm spoke to this issue in a motion he brought forward at Tuesday's City Council meeting.
We know that, you know, that the defeat you feel when you're done shoveling your driveway, especially after the winter we've just had, and that snowplow comes around the corner and you're like, yay, the snowplow. And then he goes by your driveway and leaves these massive chunks that you have no hope of clearing. And you're kind of like, yay, the snowplow.
Windrows created through municipal snowplowing operations are not only a nuisance, but can also present accessibility and service challenges for residents, particularly seniors, persons with disabilities, and households with limited capacity to remove heavy or compacted snow. Several other Ontario municipalities have implemented driveway windrow clearing programs using specialized equipment with a range of service models, eligibility criteria, and funding approaches. Bohm's motion, which received unanimous support from council, will have the city examine the possibility of implementing a similar driveway windrow clearing service in Kingston.
This is more just to explore what's the actual cost of having what other municipalities have, that extra little arm that comes down and essentially just pushes that, right? So it would push it into a bank. The technology exists. Other places around us do it, but we don't really understand what it would cost, how it would be implemented, and we're just lacking information. So realistically, this starts that conversation. It's going to give us the information, and then we'll be able to make better informed decisions going forward. I'm kind of in favor of it. I'd love to see this report come back. And realistically, we know that, you know, there's people with disabilities and accessibility issues. We know we have a large senior population. So, I mean, there's a lot of the community that's been asking for this quite some time. And when I started digging into it, realized there was a massive information gap on what the costs would actually be and how we could implement this. So that's basically what we're looking to have that conversation and get some better information on this.
Councillors around the horseshoe were supportive, citing what they've heard from their constituents on the issue over the years.
I have received a number of complaints from constituents who are predominantly senior citizens and concerns about accessibility. And so having seen this service been provided in other municipalities, I was more than happy to second the motion.
And I've also had some seniors like come in and approach me and contact me about, you know, it's like I've had to pay somebody three times today just to clear my driveway because the plow went by three times. And then, you know, and then it's like that the next day and then the next day. And then it ends up being where it's, you know, it's not an affordable thing to sustain. And I just think that this is really worth exploring because I think this is something that would really, the quality of life for the residents would be drastically improved, especially during the winter months and especially with the winter like we just had, so.
A lot of constituents in my district, they asked during the campaign and after the campaign why we cannot do this when other municipalities doing. And I think it's very important when you wake up 6 o'clock in the morning, you want to go to work, and you just clean your driveway. And after 10 minutes, you went to get shower, change the clothes, you came back, and then it's like a 2 feet, 3 feet high again, the snow in your driveway. And sometime you early evening or late evening, you clean your driveway. In the morning, you came back and you see the pile up snow again, which is also frozen. And then you have to just do it, and it's take your time, and you are late from work, especially for the senior population in our city. It's very difficult, and I think it is a good idea to look into the information, and if we can implement, and that would be great for the people living in this country. It's a great service to provide them.
City staff will now prepare a report examining clearing service models and their applicability to Kingston. The report, expected by the end of the third quarter of 2026, will include a review of programs in comparable municipalities, along with an assessment of potential service delivery options for Kingston, including associated costs, operational implications, benefits, limitations, funding considerations, and impacts on the city's ability to meet minimum maintenance standards. Following on the heels of a motion discussing snow clearing, Councillor Connie Glenn brought forward another weather-related motion, this time focused on preparing for extreme heat.
So I know it seems a little extreme, we're going from snow to heat, but here we are, Canadian to the core.
Councillor Glenn introduced a motion directing staff to report back to Council on options for a residential air conditioning unit program aimed at supporting vulnerable residents with medical conditions in the city of Kingston. Staff will review best practices from cities such as Toronto and Hamilton, which have run programs providing free portable air conditioners to low-income residents with health-related conditions in the past. They will also consult with Southeast Public Health, which could help determine eligibility and manage funding distribution for residents to receive units. Glenn made the case for the motion, stressing the importance of preparation as summer temperatures continue to rise.
The reason for bringing this forward, I think we've made some significant steps forward in terms of providing cooling. However, we're still faced with individuals who suffer extreme circumstances in the heat. In 2018, a heat wave sent 13 people to the hospital. And this is something that we're likely to see continue if we don't provide help to those who cannot help themselves in this instance. So the motion is directed very specifically for people who cannot afford their own air conditioning units, for people who are challenged with medical conditions. Now what we're basically saying is, let's have staff and let's have public health go away and come back to us with a solid recommendation that would support the people most in need. So also coming out of our climate change adaptation plan, I note that there was mention of the vast increase in the number of days of 30 plus temperatures, and that this is a general upward trajectory. So this is not an issue that is going away. I want to note a couple of other things there too. July of 2024 was the warmest month on record so far. That wasn't that long ago. So we're not seeing a change in this overall pattern, and we know that it's only going to continue to get worse at the rate that we're seeing the change happen.
Heat response has been an ongoing conversation in council chambers. In winter 2025, council approved a motion establishing a maximum indoor temperature of 26 degrees Celsius for residential units equipped with air conditioning during the summer. However, that motion was not extended to units without air conditioning already installed, due to pushback from property owners and concerns about the legality of such a requirement. While landlords in Ontario are required to provide heating, there is currently no similar obligation for cooling.
One of the things I do want to say, because this was brought up, this is not asking landlords to provide this. We understand the challenges with trying to mandate that. We're not about to turn around and do that at this point. This is just saying, for people who cannot do this for themselves, who are suffering from medical health conditions, let's put some sort of a solid program in place and support them, because really at the end of the day, what it's going to lead to is increased disability, increased numbers of people showing up at our ERs, and really this just speaks to the general well-being of our community, which I hope we're all concerned about.
The motion carried unanimously. Staff are expected to return to council with options by the end of April, a quick turnaround aimed at having a program in place for summer 2026. In a message from the City of Kingston this week, Kingston's own mayor and neighboring municipal leaders are calling on the federal government to route the proposed Alto high-speed rail project along the Highway 401 corridor and to include a stop in Kingston. In a joint statement released this week, the mayors of Kingston and South Frontenac, along with the group Save South Frontenac, say those two changes are essential if the multi-billion dollar project moves forward. They argue that aligning the rail line with the existing Highway 401 transportation corridor would reduce impacts on farmland, wetlands, and rural communities. A Kingston station, they say, would connect the region's major healthcare, education, and economic centers to fast rail service between Toronto, Ottawa, and Montreal. The statement also points to strong local opposition to the current proposed southern route and calls on the federal government to consider public feedback as planning continues. In a second message from the City of Kingston this week, with St. Patrick's Day celebrations approaching, the City of Kingston is reminding residents to celebrate responsibly. The University District Safety Initiative will be in effect starting tomorrow, March 13th through to March 18th, bringing increased bylaw and police presence to the University District. City officials say the initiative aims to prevent large nuisance parties and keep streets clear for emergency vehicles during the busy weekend. Under the city's nuisance party bylaw, hosts of disruptive gatherings could face penalties up to $2,000, while other offenses, including noise violations or refusing to leave a property, may also result in fines. Temporary parking restrictions will also be in place overnight on parts of Division, William, and Earl, with vehicles parked in restricted areas subject to towing. To learn more before celebrations kick off this weekend, you can head to the University District Safety Initiative page on the City of Kingston website. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by Ethan Churchill called Big Bad Rose, a departure from the more intimate coffee house vibes of Ethan's 2022 Coffee Dates and Superstores. This single brings a raw, tongue-in-cheek rock and roll energy that just compels you to strut your stuff. And stay tuned, Ethan's new album, The Bloody Monster Club, drops January 30th. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Big Bad Rose by Ethan Churchill now on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Welcome to another episode of the Plugged in My Ears podcast. This is episode 22 of our third season. Wow, it's been a wild ride. This time we've got Sam joining the pod today. I mean, he's been out for a couple weeks, but he's back in action, and we've got a really exciting show because you got a bit of a personal connection to some of the topics today, Sam. Tell the viewers where you're going off to tonight.
Yeah, well, I'm very fortunate. I'm going to the Montreal-Boston Bruins game today. Yeah. I'm pretty excited because, as many of you will know who are listening, the situation in the NHL is starting to get pretty contested. The playoff run is quite real.
Yes,
things are slowly starting to solidify themselves. And there is a very genuine possibility now that Montreal, if they win today and they win the next few, could be back in an almost guaranteed playoff position.
Yeah, it's getting really tight in the East, especially that Atlantic Division. Right now, Buffalo, as of Tuesday is when we're recording this, Buffalo leads with 88 points. Tampa's following with 84. And then Montreal and Detroit are tied with 82, and then Boston with 81. So tonight's game is huge. Montreal's schedule. Montreal plays Boston on Tuesday and Detroit on Thursday. So as you said, Sam, if Montreal can win those games, they're looking pretty good when it comes to the standings, but they have kind of been on a bit of a cold streak recently, losing their last two to the Anaheim Ducks and the San Jose Sharks. Now, Sam, I don't know what the vibes are like in Montreal right now, but I know that there's kind of a playoff expectation for this team because of them making the playoffs last year, and clearly the team is better. What do you think the Habs have to do to get into the playoffs other than win? Like, what do they need to do as a team?
That's a good question. What do they need to do as a team?
Yeah.
I think that now that the trade deadline's gone, the main key to success is really just ensuring that everyone's on the same page, which sounds like it's not a hard thing to do, but it really is. And I think today and in the coming days will be a really good test to see if they can do that, because they haven't been as hot as they've been recently, which sometimes is just a fluke, but sometimes it can show that the cohesiveness in the locker room is not there. Yeah. But I think if they can get everyone on the same page, they should be fine. And I do think they can make a push. Doesn't seem like too many players are injured anymore that were of critical importance. And the good thing, too, is that everyone's starting to get healthy now going into playoffs, mm-hmm. which is a really big thing. Obviously, some people will get injured here and there along the way. But, the big break is having someone get injured right as playoffs are to begin. And that doesn't seem like it's happening. It seems like the wave of injuries have already occurred, and they escaped it relatively unscathed. Mm-hmm. So as long as they can keep injuries to a minimum and get everyone on the same page, they should be good to go.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that the Kirby Dach injury is only 2 to 4 weeks. So he's going to be back. Patrick Laine has been out for a while, but apparently he's healthy. So maybe he squeaks into the lineup over these next few games. But Montreal's been usually they're plagued by injuries. And this year they've actually kind of all had everyone healthy at the right time. Like, this is these are the most important games of the year, and they've got a full strength roster now. And I mean, there's not really any excuse for them to not make it other than the fact that the Atlantic is so tight. Have you been watching any of the Boston or Detroit games and seen anything special out of those teams? Because I know Detroit is a team going through tremendous injuries right now. They're down their first three centers, Larkin, Kopp, and honestly, I don't remember the third guy, but they're down three centers, which that cannot be good for a playoff team, right? Like if you're trying to rally to make the playoffs, you can't really be down those three guys, right?
Yeah, so I think one thing people don't really consider, and I'm glad you brought this up, is that winning faceoffs dictates a lot about what will happen in a game. You can control the faceoff dot. You can control a lot of the game. And a good team in the NHL will want to win about 55 to 60% of their faceoffs or more. But if you're in that 55 to 60% range, your team's doing quite well. Detroit's in like 27, 30% faceoff win percentage. That's horrible.
Yeah.
Like 70% of the game is by default being controlled by the opposing team. That's a really big problem. But I will say, despite all that, Detroit could be doing a lot worse. I don't think they're doing as bad as they should be doing, considering that they don't have three of their starting centers. Mm-hmm. And I don't find they look too much like an AHL team right now. They still look like they're playing in the NHL. They're nothing like Chicago was in Bedard's rookie season or San Jose and Celebrini's rookie year. But I don't know how you come back from that as a team. That's tough. On the other hand, Boston, I just think Boston doesn't pack enough of a punch for what they have. Mm-hmm. I know they've lost a lot of good players recently. Patrice Bergeron, obviously he retired a little bit of a while ago, but man, was he good. Nonetheless, though, Boston should still be a powerhouse. Like they do have really good players overall.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty solid. Like, I mean, they may not have superstars, but they definitely don't have bad players.
Yeah, no, Boston's definitely a team I'd be concerned about. They are younger on the one hand because of this kind of like mini rebuild they've gone through. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, they lost those players that made them so good for so long. But yeah, they had a quick turnaround and like they're right back to being good, almost like they never left. But Detroit, on the other hand, and Buffalo, two teams that haven't made the playoffs in a minute. Like, these guys have been out for a while, and it means a lot. I think Buffalo's pretty much a lock for the playoffs at this point, just the way they've been playing. That team looks elite, which I don't think we can say too often about the Buffalo Sabres. But the Red Wings, if they don't make the playoffs this year... Like, wow. I mean, it's kind of been a collapse of a rebuild because they've been in the playoff hunt like the last three or four seasons and have stunk it up in the month of March every single one of those seasons. Obviously, this year's a little bit different with injuries. You can't really control that, but it is going to raise a few eyebrows.
What would you do if you're the owner or manager of that team? You just say, screw it, complete rebuild and soak another two or three years? Or do you try and ride this out?
Absolutely not, because I think Detroit has some of the most talented players in the NHL. I think Lucas Raymond is criminally underrated on the Red Wings, and I do think Dylan Larkin is also a solid captain. Their defense, led by Mo Sider, that is a great defenseman, and they honestly have a lot of young depth coming up. Like, they have these Jacob Bernard Docker. There's Branson Nygaard. There's all these young guys that are coming up. I don't think you can really sell the team at this point when it comes to the talent that they have. Maybe a different management style is needed. I think Yzerman has all of the tools that he wants. I just think it's up to them to kind of adapt and start maybe forcing development a little more. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I think that Detroit needs to start seeing some results. Making the playoffs this year would be a win for them. So I think I just think it is a crucial year for them to make the playoffs.
It is indeed. But one thing to be said too is a team like that with young prospects may as well just throw them out there and see what happens, in my view.
Yeah.
I always find that NHL teams are really reluctant to let the young guys play, and there's a reason for that. I think one of the best examples is Easton Cowan on the Maple Leafs. The first couple games he played, he was actually like he was still in the OHL and he could skate around everyone. I think he learned pretty quickly that it wasn't possible in the NHL. But needless to say, the more ice time you give young players, the more confident they get. The scariest thing in the NHL is a confident young player who's good.
Yeah.
That is the scariest thing in the National Hockey League.
I mean, that is scary.
Yeah, that's an easy solution to the problem in general. I just don't think that they're willing to do that because the status quo in the NHL for years has been, unless you're a top three pick, you don't get to play until you've done at least 2 years in the American Hockey League.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that should be something that they leave in the past. I don't see why they would do that. Granted, like they still have good players on the roster, but why would you not replace it? But back to the Buffalo thing, if I may, just for a second.
Absolutely.
It is remarkable that they have not been this good in the past because nothing has changed.
I know. Yeah.
Like, it's a joke that they haven't been this good.
I mean, they just changed management this during the season. And, like, I don't know if I've ever seen a mid-season management change be so successful as this one. But I think...
Do you really think that changed anything, though?
No, that's the thing. I'm confused as everyone else. I don't think it really changed much. I couldn't tell you why Buffalo was all of a sudden clicking. But I watched that Buffalo-Tampa Bay game, the 8-7 barn burner. I don't know if you, you saw that. That was also one of the most physical and full of fighting games that I've seen in a long time. And I'm like, oh my goodness, like I want to cheer for the Sabres right now. Like, like they're such a fun team to rally behind. And I only get that out of a few teams, like Montreal, Buffalo, and San Jose. You were talking about young, confident players. Macklin Celebrini is the definition of that. And he is proof as to why you let your young players play right away. Because, I mean, I haven't seen a young player on a tear like this since Sidney Crosby. Like, I think Macklin Celebrini is setting himself up very nicely for a long, long, long career in the NHL. I don't know if you got a chance to check out any of the Habs highlights against the Sharks either this week or last week, but he dominates the game, and he is still so young. Like, what do you think about Macklin?
I just find it astonishing that he doesn't even need to shave yet, and he's this good at hockey. But when you watch him play, it is kind of like watching Sidney Crosby play. Had he grown up in the era where elite skill was this focused upon? Like, Crosby was the most dominant and most skilled player in a league that was transitioning from high contact to high skill and speed.
Yeah.
And all I can think is, like, what if Crosby would play now? I think actually Celebrini is the same person as him. It's really impressive to watch him play because he kind of does play like Sid the Kid. Like, obviously, they're a bit different. They're not going to replicate each other. And I don't think anyone's ever going to use edge work like Crosby did. Granted, I think Celebrini's edge work is actually better, which is why he's so shifty. But it's impressive. I don't even know how to explain it. Yeah. Every time he's on the ice, he produces a highlight reel somehow.
Yeah, no.
It's insane.
It's incredible. It's insane.
Yeah, the only thing that I think is maybe going against him, and I don't know if this is true, I just don't have a lot of faith in San Jose's development team. And I don't know if that'll even matter, though, because he gets so much ice time, he gets the development anyways. And sometimes when you're naturally that good at hockey, it's immaterial whether or not someone else is developing you. In reality, you're developing the developers as they watch you play. And he might just be the prime example of that idea.
And that is so rare. No one is like that in the NHL unless you get generational. I really think he is up there generational, like Crosby, McKinnon, and McDavid. And already I would say that.
I bet you in 15 years there'll be two kids in uni like us discussing whether or not he should be included in the top five all time.
Yeah. I guarantee that there's going to be someone discussing that. I saw an interesting post, just getting a little even more off topic from what we were planning on talking about, but I saw this post about the projected Team North America roster for the upcoming World Cup of Hockey, and I saw that Macklin Celebrini and Connor Bedard won't even be over 25 by the time that tournament comes around. And I think that they would have been the two of the top best players on Team Canada if they were allowed to play. But they would have to play for the Team North America if that's the same format that they're going with for the World Cup of Hockey.
May well be.
Yeah. I just think that is a super dangerous team. I would not want to play Team North America.
But who else would be really good on that roster, come to think of it?
Oh, you'd get Matthew Schaefer. You'd get Schaefer on D. Lane Hutson on D. The goaltending definitely would probably be the sore spot. I think the projected goalies were Jacob Fowler, who is on the Habs, but definitely still developing.
Carter George.
Carter George was on that, and I think Trey Augustine was the other one.
Yeah, that's not great goaltending.
Yeah. So
it's not great right now, but...
Yeah, but they've got a couple years for that. 2028. Actually, you know what? This does flow very nicely into what we were going to talk about. What am I talking about? The World Cup of Hockey just got announced where they're going to be hosting it. So Calgary, Edmonton, and Prague. So three great cities. Your thoughts on the location for the World Cup of Hockey, Sam?
I'm glad it's in Canada, but Prague is friggin' cool. Holy crap, that's going to be a phenomenal experience. I don't think many people understand how insane Prague is, and I've been fairly fortunate to travel throughout Europe a decent bit. I don't think there's anything that compares to Prague other than maybe Vienna.
Yeah.
Maybe in Europe, at least. Oof. Prague is really, really cool. That's just going to be phenomenal. And the Czechs do love hockey, and the beer is great, more importantly. The beer is phenomenal. It's the best beer in the world. Fun fact, the Czechs drink the most beer of any country in the world. The average Czech adult drinks 180 liters of beer per year. And second place is the Austrian. They drink about 140.
Whoa.
That's crazy. Okay. So anyways, I mean, obviously that doesn't matter. But it tells you that it's a fun time out there. You know, people are genuinely happy life's good, life's great. So I think that's phenomenal. It being in Calgary and Edmonton is very nice. I mean, considering the political situation, it really says, hey, Alberta's in Canada. But those are great hockey towns too. So putting that aside, it's great. And I guess if players want to go to Banff and whatnot or to Jasper, it's not horribly far away. So it's relatively feasible. It's all great locations, just very far apart. I'm not sure how they're going to make a round robin that works.
Yeah.
And that allows them all to play.
I
guess that's an issue for later.
I think they'll probably end up being in like just a Group A and Group B, and then Group A plays their games in Calgary and Edmonton. Group B plays their games in Prague, and then after the round robin, they go to a knockout
who
stage.
Who plays in the North America? Who plays in Calgary and Edmonton? Canada, the U.S., Team North America.
Honestly,
who's playing in Europe then too? The Czechs, the Finns, the Swedes?
I would say that it honestly really doesn't matter. Like, as long as Canada's playing in Canada and Czechia is playing in Czechia, like, the other teams, it doesn't really matter. I feel like they could randomize that as much as possible, right?
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
It's true. I think it would be cool if they sent the North American team over there and had that cracked young roster.
Yeah, it absolutely would be. And now, you might be more aware of this than I, but I'm just taking a look at like the last the World Cup of Hockey 2016, and I noticed, of course, that Russia was in that tournament. Do you happen to know if Russia will be in the tournament coming up? Or
I don't know, but I had to guess that if the status quo doesn't change, that won't change either.
Yeah,
and even then, I don't know if Russia would be an ultra competitive team. They still have good players, but let's be realistic here. Gino's probably going to be gone.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect, unless OV has some insane amount of Russian gas with him in Washington, he probably won't be playing either. Demidov will be great, although I don't know who else from Russia will still be around that's good. Like, Kucha's getting old. Yeah. Vasilevsky's getting old. Everyone's getting old. I guess Breadman's getting old, too. Panarin's getting old.
Yeah.
I don't know who's going to be. I don't know who'll be able to play. Kaprizov, I guess, will be young enough still.
Yeah, I think he'll probably be the centerpiece of it, and then maybe Demidov is elite by then, too, so... But, I just looked it up. So Bettman said that only time will tell if Russia plays in the World Cup. So they're not ruled out yet, but it is still a possibility that Russia
does
play.
Where's that team going to play without getting bullied, though? They go play in Europe, everyone will insult and attack their bus. And if they play in Canada, I mean, people won't really care that much, but we'll just ream the shreds on the ice.
Yeah, no, it would definitely be interesting. And I'm looking at this article here, and it said Finland, Sweden, and the Czech will have notified the NHL that they will boycott the World Cup of Hockey if Russia is involved, which is crazy because Czechia is hosting part of the tournament. So,
yeah, I suspect Russia's not going to play.
Yeah, I would be surprised if they play. Wow, but yeah, no, super exciting. Obviously, international hockey is like, I mean, never been more popular than it has been the last few years. And I think it's another great opportunity to grow the game. Like you said, Prague is a fantastic city, and the Czechs are definitely a country that's on the up and up when it comes to developing hockey players. So I think this will be great for the game and really exciting for all the fans as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, hopefully the NHL doesn't include Russia then, if that's what hockey Sweden, Finland, and Czechia have said. On a separate note, talking about people getting slightly boycotted. I don't even know if he's getting boycotted, but I would say at least Brady Tkachuk's under a bit of fire. It doesn't seem like anyone cares too much about Matthew Tkachuk. It's under any fire at all. Although people in Ottawa are not extraordinarily happy with Brady Tkachuk, it seems, and correct me if I'm wrong, that he may have said some things that, well, I don't know if they warranted provocation, but at least they still provoked enough people. Because when he was on his podcast with his brother, Matthew Tkachuk said that people in Florida don't give him a hard time about his political opinions, unlike in Canada. And Brady didn't really say much to that, but that was enough for people to take it as though he was suggesting that he could take his talents otherwhere if people didn't like his political view. I'm not sure what you think about that, Adam. I have something to say about it, but I'll wait until you talk.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am honestly on the train that Brady Tkachuk is not going to be an Ottawa Senator for life. I don't really know if that was a realistic thing to say in the first place. But I think that these last few weeks have definitely solidified that for me. I think that if he does finish out the rest of his contract, he will not re-sign, no matter what. I think he will be on his way to an American team, maybe to play with his brother. And if I honestly would be surprised if he gets to the end of his contract. I think Ottawa would move him beforehand. I mean, because he is a fantastic player. Like, Ottawa could get a great return for Brady Tkachuk, and especially if they miss the playoffs this year. Like, I feel like nothing's off the table. Like, yes, I understand, like, he's your captain, right? Yeah. But first off, I'm going to be completely honest. He's a poor choice for a captain of an NHL team. And I don't know if you agree with that, but I don't think that when you look at all the captains in the NHL, he's one of the only ones that I'm like, really? That's who you chose to be your captain?
Yeah.
Really? Like, even before all this backlash and everything that he was getting and all of this turmoil that he stirred up and the Team USA team has stirred up, like, I even before then, I was like, this guy is not captain material. So, I would be surprised if he plays his whole career in Ottawa. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if he got traded. Even, I think the earliest that they could look at trading him would probably be next year's trade deadline. I think they'll even if they miss the playoffs this year, they'll give it a shot and try to ride it out and see the position they're in next year. But come next year around this time or come around trade deadline time, if they're in a similar spot, I would not be surprised if they try to offload him for a team trying to make a playoff push, because he is a good player. It's not like they can't get anything for him. They'll be able to get a good return for him, whether it's draft picks, whether it's prospects. Teams would want Brady Tkachuk on their team. Personally, I wouldn't want him as a captain, but as a role player or as a first liner, he is still very solid. So that's my opinion on Brady. I kind of feel for Senators fans, because I would hate if my captain was acting in the way that Brady Tkachuk was acting. And I just think that when you look at Montreal and their captaincy, like Nick Suzuki, I mean, Nick Suzuki barely says any words when he's asked questions. And I think that's sometimes better when it comes to speaking your mind. So I don't know. I'm not necessarily to say that Nick Suzuki is a better captain than Brady Tkachuk or not, but I just don't think that this is how I would want my captain acting if I was a player on the team, if I was management, or if I was a fan of the Senators.
Yeah, no, I agree. So I think I've often been a pretty vocal proponent of the fact that Brady Tkachuk is not a good captain. Mm-hmm. He's a good senator, though. I agree with you. He's a great hockey player, great first line player. I don't think anyone can take that away from him.
Yeah.
I don't know who would replace him as captain on Ottawa, but that's not really the issue. I think the bigger thing is what you said about Nick Suzuki and that he says very little things. Mm-hmm. People probably don't remember this, but when Michael Jordan was with the Bulls, there was a huge fiasco in the news because he wouldn't comment on whether or not what the governor had said was racist, and he wasn't denouncing it, and he wasn't saying his political stance. And Michael's answer was really simple. One day it was really pissing him off, and Michael Jordan said, "My job is to play basketball. It's not to tell little boys and little girls what they should think. Hmm. They can figure that out on their own." And people don't really remember that, but also that's not a bad thing that they don't remember that. No. People remember Michael Jordan because of what he did on the court, not what he did off of it. Yeah. And I think Brady Tkachuk is heading down that path where people are going to start to remember him more for what he did off the ice, rather than on the ice. And that's not something a good captain does.
No.
You know, Daniel Alfredson definitely has political opinions. Literally no one knows what they are. And he will always be everyone's idol for that reason. Because he's virtually impossible to dislike. He was such a good captain. The same is true as Crosby, and Nick Suzuki will have that same reputation as well. I mean, he may not have the same cultural influence as other captains have had in Montreal, but people will still remember him for being a good, virtuous captain who essentially did his job, which was to play hockey.
Yeah,
I think a lot of people forget, and a lot of hockey players specifically forget, that because they can have an opinion doesn't mean that they must have an opinion. Mm-hmm. And in a game like this, where your image is your career, not expressing opinions sometimes is better for your career. And it's not to say that they shouldn't express their opinions, whatever. If he wants to do it, then he should. That's fine. But that's also not someone who will be a captain in the NHL, because that's not what the job profile says.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And I think you're not the only one that thinks this. I think this is kind of becoming more of a widespread view among Senators fans. And yeah, no, my heart goes out to you because I honestly do think that the Senators would be better off with another player as captain or as the leader of that team.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it would be completely different. I don't think they would be like top of the Atlantic with a different captain, but I do think that they would be definitely viewed differently around the league. Maybe with more respect. Yeah, no. Anyways, talking about another Canadian team, the Edmonton Oilers, they are kind of in an interesting place right now. So they are currently in a playoff spot, one of the last playoff spots in the Pacific Division, which is criminally weak. Vegas has like more losses than wins this year. And they're either first or second in the division. It kind of flip-flops every night just with how close the division is. But a major blow to the Oilers is that they've lost Leon Draisaitl for the rest of the year with a lower body injury. And they said that he would be back for the playoffs, but the Oilers kind of have to make the playoffs first. So this is going to be a little bit of a challenge. Right now, Anaheim leads the Pacific with 77 points. And just to put that into perspective, 77 points in the Eastern Conference is the Ottawa Senators. So it is a weak division. But the Ducks are in first with 77. The Golden Knights in second with 76. The Oilers are in third with 75. And then when you look at the wild card, Utah's the first wild card team with 76. So one more point than the Oilers. And then the second wild card team is the Seattle Kraken. And the LA Kings are tied with 71. So they have a 4-point buffer over the next Pacific team and that last wild card spot. So they have some space to work with, but the Sharks are there with 70 points. The Predators are there with 67. The Jets are there with 66. And honestly, the Blues are there with 64. So it's not all said and done with just how bad the Oilers have been. Are you confident that Connor McDavid can carry this team to the playoffs without Leon Draisaitl?
Well, look, that's the big test. Now Connor McDavid must prove that he truly is as good as everyone else thinks he is. Sidney Crosby was able to carry the Penguins when Malcolm was out, and conversely, Malcolm was able to carry them when Crosby was out.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'm not too convinced that McDavid can do it. Yeah. I actually think he's a really good player, but I think Edmonton's absolutely garbage outside of him and Draisaitl. So it's difficult. I mean, basically, what they've done is they've taken the greatest player in the NHL and put him on a U16 AAA team, and they're asking him to go up against a bunch of other really bad NHL teams that are semi-AHL teams. It won't be easy, but it's doable. But I do think Draisaitl being out's a huge blow for the Oilers, and it will tarnish McDavid's reputation because he's proven clutch once with the goal for Canada against the United States in the Four Nations Cup, but no Stanley Cup, two failures in the Stanley Cup Finals. Yeah. And if he can't take his team to the playoffs without Draisaitl, unfortunately, that's another stain on his white shirt, and those are hard to take out.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I do think that this is going to come back down to what we talked about a couple months ago about how Connor McDavid signed that two-year bridge deal. And, I mean, it's not looking great for the Oilers if they miss the playoffs this year. Wow, is that next year going to be important? Like, you better win the Stanley Cup or else Connor McDavid is leaving the Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah, and I don't think he desperately wants to stay in Edmonton anyways. I think McDavid sees that there's a brighter side of things in the NHL.
Yeah.
I don't think he would want to go to Toronto. I think he saw what happened to Mitch Marner and be delighted to avoid having that happen. But I could totally see him going to the States, oddly enough.
Yeah.
Lower taxes in some spots. He's going to be the most highly paid player in the NHL. If I was him and I was searching for money and for rings and for Stanley Cups, there's definitely better teams to play for south of the border. I don't think the Canadian prospect for him is too great right now. Even if he were to go to another Canadian team, I don't know who he would choose to go to. Maybe Montreal, but I don't think they could pay for him.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he'd fit into that team chemistry anyways, because Montreal has sort of created this thing where they have a bunch of high-end players but no superstar players, so they're able to retain all these guys that are really good but that aren't crazy expensive.
Yeah.
And that's worked out fabulously for them. Let's be real, the American teams plus Toronto are the ones that have the big dollars.
Yeah.
So I just don't see him going anywhere else in Canada.
Yeah. A crazy time right now in the NHL, and only time will tell what happens with all these storylines. Sam, enjoy your Habs game tonight. I hope you're the good luck charm. If they win, you're going to have to go to every single game till the end of the year, okay?
Sounds good. I'm glad you're paying for it.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, well, we'll see you next week on Plugged in My Ears. This has been Adam and Sam. Have a great evening.
The Office of VP Research offers undergraduate students meaningful opportunities to engage in discovery-based learning and to develop research and presentation skills through their Undergraduate Student Summer Research Fellowship and the Undergraduate Student Research Award. Do you self-identify as a Black or Indigenous person? There are allocated funds through the USRA to help address the disproportionate underfunding of Black and Indigenous scholars.